noted, and someone in records would run them through the computer in hopes the gun was registered. A superficial examination showed the weapon had been wiped clean of prints, and a single round had been fired. When we finally sat down to chat, I said, "How soon will you know who owns the Ruger?" "Assuming it's registered at all, it may take a while. Records is backed up, and I didn't put a rush on the request. I'm fascinated to hear how it ended up in your car." "I'll give you my best guess," I said. I then laid out an explanation of Terence Dace's backpack being stolen by the panhandlers, Pearl's spotting it, and her determination to get it back. Chaney was more patient than I had any reason to hope. In addition to recounting my participation in the raid and what I remembered of Felix's actions, I used the occasion to talk about the Boggart Savage attack, which I was now convinced was because Felix had taken property that didn't belong to him. He said, "You think Felix stole the gun from them?" "It's the only explanation that makes sense." He was hunched in the back seat as we left the scene, and he's the only one who's been back there. I think he was attacked because he came across the weapon at the camp and slipped it into the small of his back. I think the panhandlers bided their time and came after him. If he'd told them where he'd hidden it, they'd have come after me. The owner of that bicycle rental shop down on Lower State saw the whole thing, and he's the one who called 911. I talked to him a couple of days ago, hoping he'd be willing to identify the guy. He knows who it was because he's seen the same three bums hanging out at the beach for years. He refuses to help because he's worried about reprisals. And who can blame the man? Chaney made a note. "Let me find out who's handling the case, and we'll see what we can do. You said three of them?" "It's the big galoot I'm talking about. Bald guy with a red baseball cap."
"You have a name?"
"I don't. But he's not hard to find. Rush hour, he's usually standing on the side of the Cabana Boulevard off-ramp with a cardboard sign. You can't miss him."
"You think he had a hand in Pete's death?"
"Either that or he stumbled on the weapon after the fact. I can't think how else he'd end up with it."
"Might be completely unrelated," Chaney said. "So far, we haven't confirmed this was the gun used in the shooting. With all the firearms in circulation, plenty aren't registered and can't be traced."
"I'll tell you one thing. Those bums are badasses. They put together that camp with stolen goods. They've tapped into the zoo's water and electrical supplies, and they've co-opted trash pickup. There must be a half a dozen ways to bust them."
"We'll do what we can. If the fellow you describe has been in trouble with the law, it will give us some talking points."
"I want to run something by you. I've been thinking about this, and I'd be interested in your opinion," I said. "Leaving aside the issue of how I came up with all this..."
"All this what?"
"Would you let me tell it my way? This is pertinent."
"Fine."
He looked at me steadily. Instead of making eye contact, I found it easier to avert my gaze. I knew what I wanted to say, but I was organizing the story as I went along. "This may take a while, so bear with me. Originally, Pete Walensky was hired by a fellow named Willard Bryce," I said. Then I went through the entire sequence, Pete hiring Dietz, the surveillance, Dietz billing Pete, no pay. I told him about Mary Lee meeting with Owen Penske and her quitting her job the same day Pete was shot to death. I told him about the stolen charts. I told him about Eloise Cantrell, who made reference to gossip about Dr. Reed's work. As I worked my way through the narrative, I could see Chaney putting together the bits and pieces. He gave no indication of what he was thinking, but I could feel my confidence erode as I went on. "Pete had a shitload of debts, and he was desperate for cash. I think he got wind of Dr. Reed's problems and saw an opportunity to put the squeeze on him. You know, pay up or I'll tell your boss and I'll contact the NIH. Chaney cut in.
Did Pete actually have evidence of wrongdoing?
I don't know. Probably not. He might have suggested that even the hint of wrongdoing would tarnish Reed's reputation and impact his career.
So you think he tried blackmailing Linton Reed over an issue of I don't know what without anything to back it up?
It doesn't matter if he had anything to back it up. What matters is whether Linton Reed believed Pete would blow the whistle on him. What matters is Reed's anxiety about the kind of trouble Pete could make.
Are you talking about scientific fraud?
That's what it sounds like to me. He's been in trouble before over lesser issues than this.
You told me Mary Lee Bryce quit her job.
She did. The same day Pete was killed.
If she quit her job, where's the threat to Linton Reed?
She's more likely to blow the whistle on him now. Besides, I have these medical charts Day stole. Those should help.
In the meantime, I did meet with Dr. Reed.
That caught him short.
Why?
I wanted to hear what he had to say about Terence Dace.
And?
He expressed regret about the deaths. He talked about how the study is set up and why he terminated Dace and his friend.
Honestly, he made it all sound reasonable.
I'm sure he did, he said. I'm trying to be fair about this, Cheney. That's what I'm getting at. I'm not demonizing the guy. I'm not even saying he did anything on purpose. He had a theory about glucotase. When he ran into a roadblock, instead of shutting the study down, he changed the data or deleted it.
Weak.
I know it's weak. Most of this is circumstantial, but don't sit there telling me it doesn't count.
Speculation. No real basis in fact. You think doctors won't stand together in a situation like this?
Indulge me, okay?
He smiled. I'm already doing that. This is me indulging you.
Just listen. Ruthie found a wad of cash that Pete stashed away. Suppose Linton's prints are on the bills. Wouldn't that suggest I'm on track here?
You're grasping at straws. I don't understand how we get from fraud to homicide.
Easy. Pete jacked him up for money. Reed paid him once, but he didn't want to pay again. So, he killed him.
Where's the gun? Does Linton even own one?
I have no idea.
You don't even know for sure Pete and Linton Reed knew each other.
Oh, but I do. Pete met with Reed on July 12th out at UCST. I saw his name in the appointment book, and Ruthie has the properly validated parking ticket, so don't be a shit.
I am a shit. That's my job. I'm telling you what will fly and what won't. All a defense attorney has to do is come up with a plausible explanation. All he needs is a story that covers the same points but with a different slant. You make it look one way, fine. He can make it look like something else. Right now, there's no eyewitness, and the motive is imaginary. Some guy says he'll expose you. You tell him to take a hike. You don't fork over a couple of $1,000 and then shoot his ass.
I reached for the bag I had placed at my feet and took out the shrink-wrapped prescription bottle. This is one of Dace's prescriptions. He believed they put him on glucotase along with antabuse and another drug to reduce his craving for nicotine. I asked Dr. Reed straight out if Dace was taking glucotase or the placebo. He thought about it briefly and said placebo. Can't you get these analyzed and find out what they are?
Why would we do that? There's no case.
But if the pills turn out to be glucotase, it would support my argument, wouldn't it?
Tenuous, at best.
You have a better theory? You even have a suspect, because I'm offering both.
I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm saying I can't sell this. The DA's tough. She won't file if she doesn't think she's got something solid under her feet.
I could see him turn the issue over in his mind.
Promise me your access to this information is legitimate. Of course. I tucked the pills back into my bag. No breaking and entering. I raised a hand as though swearing an oath. You never impersonated an officer.
I didn't impersonate anybody. When I talked to Willard, I said I was a former colleague of Pete's, which is true. I gave him my business card, so no funny business there.
He shook his head. An investigation like this would take months.
I understand. Just let me know if anything new develops. That's all I ask.
Sure. But don't hold your breath.
Chapter 34.
I didn't hear from Cheney until the following Tuesday morning. The Rugers registered to a man named Sanford Ray.
I don't know what I thought he was going to say, but it wasn't that.
Who's he?
Film producer.
He started out as a venture capitalist, and he's been involved with Hollywood for the past 6 years. He lives in Montebello and commutes when he has a project in the works. Jonah's been filling in the blanks. Ray's heavy into charities, and he's on a half a dozen boards. Big cheese in town.
Does he have a criminal history?
Nope. His record's clean.
I never heard of the guy. Does the name mean anything to you?
I found myself pacing in front of my desk, telephone in hand. Cheney said, Hollywood moguls aren't high on my list. The last movie I saw was Dirty Harry, so Clint Eastwood's it.
How does Sanford Ray know Pete?
Remains to be seen. We haven't talked to him.
When will you do that?
Jonah's checking to see if he's in town. Once we track him down, we'll pay him a visit and have a nice long chat.
I'd love to be there when you do.
Cheney made a sound that said, not in our lifetime. We don't know how he's going to react. He could barricade himself in the house, break out a window, and shoot at us. We might end up calling in the SWAT team.
Or not, I said.
I sat down, hoping to calm myself. I couldn't tell if I was nervous, anxious, or excited, but my blood pressure was up.
Cheney said,
the explanation might be innocent. The gun was stolen, and he wasn't aware of it, or he knew the gun was gone, and he hadn't reported it. If we brought along a civilian, he could file a complaint.
That was just wishful thinking on my part, I said.
I know I won't be tagging along. Department policy, public safety, or whatever else you care to cite.
Good girl.
Will you tell me what he says?
Probably. The gist of it, at any rate.
Not the gist. I want you to swear you'll remember everything he says and repeat the conversation back to me, word for word.
You got it. Word for word.
I couldn't think what to make of this odd turn of events. I was suddenly facing an information gap. Up popped Sanford Ray, and until Cheney filled in the blanks, I had to let go. I returned to the office, happy to be picking up the old routines. No new business yet, but that would take care of itself in due course. I knew William was hard at work on his plans for the two funerals, and I was just about resigned to footing the bill. At least it would be something to occupy my time. I was sitting at my desk in the little bungalow downtown when I heard someone open and close the front door. Anna appeared. Here it was October, and she was in a tank top and a pair of short shorts.
Can I talk to you?
I hadn't seen her for days, but Henry had told me she'd picked up a job in a beauty salon on Lower State Street, which allowed her to walk to work. She was still bunking at his place, but since he had no objections, I didn't see how I could complain.
I said, sure, have a seat.
I hear you found work. How's it going?
She perched on the edge of one of my visitor's chairs.
The job's fine. Still minimum wage, but I like the place.
Good. What can I do for you?
Gee, well, let's just get down to business here.
Sorry. I didn't know you came to chit-chat.
I think I made a mistake.
This was interesting. I swear, if she'd had a hanky in hand, she'd be twisting it. I noticed I wasn't getting the benefit of those big blue eyes of hers.
I waited.
I talked to Dr. Reed. Henry lent me his car, and I drove out to the university.
This was Thursday of last week.
Well, yes, but I haven't seen you since then, or I'd have told you earlier.
I wasn't accusing you of anything, I said.
When I told Dr. Reed I was Terence Dace's daughter, he was confused about why I was there when he'd already talked to you earlier that day. He got all pissy and said he couldn't understand why you hadn't just passed the information along.
To which you replied,
I was so rattled I don't remember now. But that's not the point. I thought he knew what you did.
About what?
Your work. He didn't know you were a private detective.
How did that come up?
I was just making conversation. I told him I hadn't been in town long. I said I was staying with your landlord who owns the studio you rent on the same property. I said it worked out well for both of you because you were sometimes on the road. Dr. Reed asked if you were in sales, and then I mentioned what you did for a living. He got upset you never identified yourself. He said you acted like you were having any old conversation about a family member. That's what it was. I wasn't there in any professional capacity. But you asked all those questions about the program.
He volunteered.
I didn't even know enough to ask. That's not how he remembers it.
I considered the situation briefly. I don't see how any harm was done, I said. I'd have preferred your keeping my personal life to yourself, but it's too late to worry about that now.
I lied a little bit and said you'd given me some of the information, but what I'd really come to ask him was something else. I told him Ethan's concerns that Daddy's medication might have affected his mind. Dr. Reed blew his stack. The guy's a basket case. He wanted to know why everybody was suddenly so interested. He said my father didn't suffer dementia or any other mental impairment. He was taking a placebo, and it wouldn't have had that effect.
Good news for me and bad for you, I said. I guess the will's back in effect.
You don't have to make jokes about it.
Sorry, I didn't mean to be flip.
Anyway, I didn't see why he had to get so huffy. I felt like I really put my foot in it. And then to make matters worse, this other business came up.
Please, don't make me guess.
Well, I knew one of those homeless people gave you a bottle of Daddy's pills, I cut in, saying, Who told you that?
Henry.
I was close to pressing her further when I picked up the unspoken message.
And you told Dr. Reed?
I was not actually shrieking, but she must have guessed the level of my outrage from the expression on my face.
I didn't know it was any big secret. But why would you do that? Why in the world would you do that? Why would the subject even come up?
Because he said if I went through Daddy's things, I should keep an eye out. He said 14 pills were missing, and I said you had them.
Is the concept of minding your own business completely foreign to you?
I told you not to go out there.
I knew no good would come of it.
I didn't do it on purpose. I mean, I went on purpose, but I didn't mean to make trouble. It just came out. I was trying to help. I was trying to smooth things over.
So, now what happens?
Nothing. He'd appreciate it if you'd return them. He says addicts will take any drug they get their hands on in hopes of getting buzzed.
But those are placebos. So what's the risk?
I'm telling you what he said. Daddy signed a form and agreed to abide by the rules.
But your father didn't abide by the rules, Anna, which is why they kicked him out.
Dr. Reed was the one who made the decision, so as far as I'm concerned, all bets are off.
I understand why you're irritated. You already went out there once, but there's no big rush. He said by the end of the week would be fine.
This isn't a negotiation. I'm not giving him anything. I didn't sign an agreement, so the rules don't apply to me.
You can't refuse. He has a government grant. He has to account for everything. With a clinical trial, you can't just do anything you please. There are strict guidelines.
Strict guidelines? Wow, I don't know what to say.
This is stupid. I'm not going to sit here and argue.
That is the best news I've had so far.
I don't know why you're making such a big deal of it.
Because I'm having a bad day and you're not helping me, okay? Neither is Linton Reed.
Well, you don't have to take that attitude. He said if you didn't want to make the drive to the university, he'd stop by and pick them up himself.
So now he's the pill police?
He has a responsibility.
Well, I don't doubt that. Happily, he has no idea where I live. That's when I got the big blue eyes.
Do not tell me you gave him my address.
She dropped her gaze.
When he asked, I gave him my address. What was I supposed to say?
I stood up and leaned across the desk. My voice had dropped so low I wasn't sure she'd hear what I was saying unless she knew how to read lips. Please get out of my office. I don't want to see you. I don't want to talk to you. If you so much as catch sight of me, you better run the other way. Have I made myself clear? She got up without another word and left, slamming the door behind her. After I'd cleaned the office from top to bottom, I realized I'd probably gone too far with her. What difference did it make if he knew where to find me? True, I harbored the suspicion that he might have had a hand in Pete's death, but he didn't know that. As far as I was concerned, he had no power over me, and he had no leverage. So, what was there to sweat? If he had the gall to come knocking at my door, I'd tell him I'd toss the pills. That settled, I retrieved said bottle from my shoulder bag, pulled the rug back, opened my floor safe, and locked the pills away. Cheney called late in the afternoon, saying, "I have a 1-hour dinner break. I'm buying if you want to join me." He knew full well I wouldn't refuse. I said, "You did talk to Sanford Ray, right?" I held the handset loosely, pen and paper at the ready in case I needed to take notes. "First thing this morning. Hey, we're old friends by now. He asked me to call him Mr. Ray. That's how tight we are." "What did he say about the gun?" "I'm not doing this on the phone. We're starting to cook on this, I can tell you that. We picked up partial prints, thumb and index finger." "Oh, come on, Cheney, don't make me wait. I want to know what went on." "I'll pick you up in an hour. How do you feel about eating breakfast at dinner time?" "I love the idea." I was home and waiting at the curb when Cheney came around the corner in his red Mercedes-Benz Roadster. I found myself mentally cocking my head. I was thinking about Robert Dietz and his red Porsche, wondering if Jonah Robb had a little red sports car as well. Cheney leaned across the seat and opened the passenger side door. I slid into the black leather bucket seat and said, "Is this the car you had when I saw you last?" "That was an 87. This is the 88, a 560 SL. You like it?" "I thought the other one was a 560 SL. "It was. I was so crazy about the car, I got a duplicate." He drove us out onto the wooden pier, the big timbers rumbling beneath his wheels. The restaurant was 3 blocks from my apartment, but it wasn't one I frequented. We ate at a table overlooking the harbor with its modest traffic and powerboats and fishing vessels. Not surprisingly, the restaurant was given over to a nautical theme. Black and white photographs of sailboats, fish netting draped along the walls, distressed wood, buoys, and other maritime artifacts, including fiberglass fish reproductions, 2 marlins, 3 sharks, and a school of sailfish. As we ate, I wondered idly if you could classify men according to their breakfast preferences. Cheney was a pancake kind of guy, crisp bacon, breakfast sausage, eggs over easy. He piled it all together, poured syrup over the top, and cut it into a big nasty pile that he devoured with enthusiasm. He wasn't a big man, but he never seemed to gain weight. I ordered scrambled eggs, bacon, rye toast, and orange juice. When we finally pushed our plates aside and the waitress had refreshed our coffee cups, I said, "Are you going to volunteer the information, or do I have to beg?" "I am happy to tell you the story, but I'm taking out the filler. You know how it is. You show up at a guy's door asking about a gun. There's all this preliminary bullshit while they decide if they should hire legal counsel before letting you set foot on the premises. Okay, so the nitty-gritty. He answers the door, we introduce ourselves, and I ask if he has a .45-caliber Ruger semi-automatic registered to him. This is me and Jonah, by the way. He says he does. We ask where the gun is. He says his bed table drawer. We say we'd like to see the weapon if he has no objections. He says, none whatever. So far, this is going great, but just to be on the safe side, we clarify the request, letting him know he has the right to refuse. By now, he's getting antsy. We reaffirm we have his consent to come in and take a look. He says, what the hell is this? We tell him the Ruger might have been used in the commission of a crime, which he says is bullshit. I thought you were skipping the filler. This is the important Fourth Amendment stuff. Something goes wrong, I don't want him claiming we didn't spell it out for him. So there's more back and forth before he gets down to it. Okay, so after that little verbal skirmish, he decides not to argue the point. We all troop into the bedroom where he opens the bed table drawer. Sure enough, there's a gun. Obviously not the Ruger, because Jonah's holding that in an evidence bag. First thing Ray says is, that's not my gun. So we ask if he recognizes the gun, and he says, of course not. He never saw it in his life. So then we go back and quiz him as to his whereabouts the night of August 25th. Turns out he was on location in North Carolina, where his company's shooting a film. We show him the Ruger, which he identifies as his. Now we're making progress. We ask how he acquired it. He says he bought it 2 years ago after a rash of home invasions in Los Angeles, where he was living. Both he and his wife had themselves safety certified before he made the purchase. After that, they took shooting lessons. Very conscientious, and we're quick to compliment him for being such a good citizen. We ask him when's the last time he or his wife handled the Ruger, and he names the occasion, which was maybe 5 months back. They went target shooting, and he cleaned the gun afterward. I leaned forward. He can prove he was out of town? No question. And please remember, this is coming out of left field, so he's had no time to prepare. Okay, so the gun is his, but he was gone. Now what? There's a kicker. I hope it's good. I don't know how good it is, but it's interesting. I take that back. It's good and it's interesting. I made that rolling hand gesture, hoping to speed him along. Once we tell him the semi-automatic in the drawer might be the one used in a shooting death, he's practically begging us to get the damn thing out of his house. We bag and tag and go back to the station where we run the serial numbers. And you know what we find? The gun's not registered. It is registered. You want to guess who to? Cheney, would you quit this? Either tell me or don't tell me, but don't play games. Whose gun was it?
Pete Walensky's.
I told Cheney I'd walk home. He had to get back to work, and I needed the air. Nothing made sense. How had Pete's Glock 17 ended up in some stranger's bed table drawer? What was that about?
We'd gone through the story a second time. Once the gun was identified as Pete's, the Rays were invited downtown for further conversation, and they couldn't have been more cooperative. Both agreed to have their prints rolled. Sanford Ray didn't know Pete Walensky. He'd never even heard the name, nor had his wife, Gail. Neither had a criminal history. Both husband and wife were out of state the night Pete was killed. Their home security system had been activated, and there were no reports of an alarm. Jonah asked them to make a list of everyone who'd had access to the house in their absence, and they'd given it to him on the spot. Not that many, as it turned out. House cleaners, Ray's personal assistant, a couple of family members who were coming in at Jonah's request. In the meantime, ballistics was now in possession of both the Ruger and the Glock 17, and they'd determine which slugs had been fired from which gun. It was almost dark by the time I reached home. I'd left lights on for myself, but Henry's place was dark. I figured he was up at Rosie's, so I did a turnabout and walked the half block. I was itchy with anxiety, but I wasn't up to a social visit unless we could talk in private. Rosie's front windows were plastered with the usual beer and liquor ads, but a quick peek revealed Anna sitting at the table with Henry. Except for the boobs, I wasn't jealous of her, but she was getting on my nerves. Walking back to my place, I passed an unfamiliar turquoise Thunderbird, which I imagined was one of Rosie's patrons taking up valuable parking space. I let myself into my studio and flipped off the porch light. I sat down at my desk, gathered my index cards, secured them with a rubber band, and tossed them into my bottom drawer. With Cheney and Jonah on it, my notes were beside the point. The sole remaining keepsake, if you want to think of it as such, was Pete's cardboard box that I was using as a footrest. I still believed I was right. Given my particular personality disorder, once I get on a thought track, I have trouble getting off. I felt a nearly irresistible urge to create another, better explanation for Pete's death, but I resisted. Once I'm convinced B follows A and that Y precedes Z, it doesn't matter what I'm looking at. That's what I see. I'd developed a theory about Pete's relationship to Linton Reed, and I made sure everything fit. Which, I realized now, was much the same thing Linton Reed was doing with his data trimming, only without the loss of life. I wondered, belatedly, I grant you, if I'd been using this entire enterprise as a way of avoiding anxiety about the sudden drop in business. I'd been thinking of these past weeks as unpaid vacation time, immersing myself in the issues of Dace's last will and testament so I could feel busy and productive, when in fact I had no money coming in. I was not without ample savings, but I didn't want to go through my rainy day funds. I'm cheap. I grew up in pinched circumstances. Financial excess is good. Penury is not. I lifted my head and realized I was hearing a steady stream of cat talk outside. Ed had probably been chatting for some time, but I hadn't been tuned in. I went to the door and peered out the porthole, angling my gaze so I could see the doormat. Sure enough, Ed was sitting there, the two rows of potted marigolds forming a runway on either side of him. I flipped on the porch light and opened the door, saying, "How do you manage this? I know Henry didn't leave you out." He said something that I didn't get. He came in, possibly to inspect the premises. He began a leisurely tour, making sure all was in order. "Hang on," I said.
Maybe Anna had been careless. More likely, the cat had some secret means of ingress and egress. I grabbed Henry's keys, picked up Ed, and tucked him under one arm, flipping the thumb lock to the unlocked position before I closed the door behind me. My personal escort service might have been his scheme all along, since he immediately began to purr. I unlocked Henry's back door and dropped the cat inside. I returned to my place, crossing the patio, which was washed in weak light from my porch lamp. I turned the doorknob and discovered that I'd locked myself out. Well, that was irritating. I must have locked the door when I thought I was unlocking it. My handbag and keys were inside, and I was stuck outside. I assessed the situation and realized it was a minor inconvenience, easily remedied. I could either let myself into Henry's kitchen and snag his spare keys, which included one for my door, or I could trot up to Rosie's, suffer Anna's company, and have him buy me a glass of wine. I opted for the wine. It wasn't until I turned to leave that I realized Linton Reed was standing in the shadow of the driveway. He wore a dark overcoat. He looked completely out of place in the midst of such familiar sights. The Adirondack chair and the aluminum lawn chair were still pulled close together, as though William and I hadn't finished talking. There was a trowel on Henry's potting bench that he might have left there 2 minutes ago instead of the hours it had probably been. Clay pots of marigolds awaited placement around the edges of the patio. Linton Reed had his hands in his coat pockets, and he was completely still. This seemed odd to me. Charming people like great white sharks are always in motion. Their charm depends on sleight of hand, a smile, a tone, anything to suggest they have an active inner life that fuels the public image. They depend on motion to give them breath. It's because they're dead inside that they work so hard to maintain the illusion that they have souls. "Hi, Dr. Reed," I said. "Anna said you might stop by." I moved toward him, showing what a friendly little thing I was. His reply was late in coming by 2 beats. "Did she now?" His tone wasn't accusatory. It was thoughtful, as though he were contemplating the possibility. "She said you wanted to pick up that bottle of pills." Again, the slow response. "When we spoke, you didn't tell me you had them." "Because I didn't at that point. After you talked about the danger of unidentified medications in circulation, I asked a couple of Dace's friends if they knew what he'd done with his pills. As it happens, he'd given them to a homeless fellow who turned them over to me. I threw them in the trash. I hope that was all right." He'd triggered the chatty side of my nature, which often comes to the fore when I'm worried I'll wet my pants. "That's not why I'm here." "Oh, well, good. Because the point is, I don't have the pills. If I did, I'd give them to you. I certainly have no use for them myself." "You led me to believe you had a simple query about a family member when all the time you sat there convinced I'd done something bad. I didn't come here asking about the pills. You jumped to the subject yourself because you're guilty of such deceit." "I have no reason to feel guilty." He ignored that comment. "I received a call from Eloise Cantrell, who says you accosted her on the street, asking questions about me." "I didn't accost her. How ridiculous. I ran into her at St. Terry's as she was leaving for the day. I knew she worked on the CCU because she'd called me months ago when Dace was admitted. I asked if she knew you, and she said she did. That's all it was. I'd talked to you earlier, and it just seemed like a happy coincidence." I watched his face cloud over. He shook his head, frowning. "Something's off. Let's go back.
You came to my office unannounced, hoping to catch me off guard. You presented yourself in a false light, gathering information for reasons known only to yourself.
I probably should have been more forthcoming, I said. Here's what happened. I'm sure you know Terence Dace was suspicious and confused. His behavior was erratic, and he harbored paranoid fantasies. I thought I should look into it. It had nothing to do with you personally. I got involved because he'd drawn up a will in which he disinherited his children and left everything to me. I was concerned about a legal challenge, so I was doing my due diligence. Wincing, he pressed the flat of his hand to the side of his face, like a child with a painful ear infection.
You keep talking and talking. You use talk as a cover for something else, but I don't know what it is.
Really, I don't. I think you've misunderstood.
No, I have not. You're devious. I don't know how else to describe your behavior.
I haven't meant to be devious.
But it's your nature, isn't it?
I don't think so. I wouldn't say that about myself.
Do you have any idea how perilous your position is?
Perilous?
I have you to thank for what's happening. It's as simple as that. When we spoke in my office, I didn't grasp your agenda. I was at fault there for not being quicker off the mark. My apologies.
In a situation like this, it's of little comfort knowing you're right. I was right about Linton Reed. I'd been right all along, but who was I going to tell?
I don't have an agenda, I said.
Yes, you do. You talk to people about me. You write things down. You think about things that are none of your concern.
I haven't done anything to you. I asked a few questions, but only to determine Dace's state of mind when he changed the will.
Dr. Reed was exasperated.
You're lying again. You've undercut whatever credibility you had. I was offering you a chance to explain yourself, and you're throwing off all this smoke.
I had a quick little chat with myself, saying, here's a tip, self. Do not argue with a lunatic. Arguing with a lunatic simply ensures that you'll climb into his craziness with him when what you want to do is take a big step back. He held up his right hand.
Do you see this?
His fingertips were black.
The police insisted on taking my prints. Can you imagine my humiliation? My wife was there, and they took hers as well. The detective was polite, but I hated the way he looked at me. He was taking my measure. He weighed every word I said. I've never been treated like that in my life, but I had to maintain control of myself because I knew he'd be writing things down.
I was getting cold standing out on the patio in the half-light. A thought popped to mind, one of those insights that comes too late to be of any use. This felt like that game show where the contestants are given an answer and asked to frame the relevant question. I said, "Who is Sanford Ray?"
"He's my father-in-law."
I nodded, my mouth suddenly too dry to form a response. I caught motion on the drive. I looked over and spotted Anna just as she spotted me. She turned on her heel. Linton glanced in that direction.
"Who are you looking at?"
I cleared my throat and tried again. "Neighborhood dog. He's always wandering into the yard." He closed his eyes, testing the truth value of the statement. For once, I was lying outright, and Linton missed it. So maybe he wasn't as smart as he thought. Maybe I wasn't that smart either, because Anna might have helped me if I hadn't read her the riot act. I said, "You know what? Why don't we forget all this and start from scratch? Somehow I gave you the wrong impression, and I apologize.
Impression? We're not talking about impressions. We're talking about the truth of what's going on.
Which is what? I'm not getting this.
You're ruining my life. You're tearing down everything I worked so hard to achieve. I shook my head, saying, I'm not. I wouldn't do that.
He smiled slightly.
Well, perhaps you're right. I suppose there's no point in arguing, since it won't change anything.
For a moment, I was quiet. Linton Reed was about to declare himself. Then again, so was I.
You know what your problem is? He fixed his attention on me. He'd been in that strange little twisted world of his where he was the king.
What's that?
You don't know a Ruger from a Glock.
His smile faded, and his eyes went dead. He removed a flat silver case from his coat pocket and triggered the lid. I couldn't bring myself to look. I kept my eyes locked on his. Was there anyone alive in there? My heart had started to bang as though I had just climbed a flight of stairs.
Look what I brought for you, he said.
I looked down. The interior was lined with black velvet. In the center was a scalpel. A jolt of ice moved down my spine, chilling every nerve it touched. The effect was odd, like that spritzy jangle you feel when you contact a hot wire.
This was my specialty. My first love, he said.
He plucked the scalpel from its velvet bed, snapped the case shut, and returned it to his coat pocket. He held the surgical instrument so it caught the light.
I call him the Biter. He's quick and sharp. This blade is my favorite. A number 12. You see how this portion curves? That's his music. A sweet high note you'll hear when he whistles through your flesh.
His eyes met mine.
No need to be apprehensive. You won't suffer.
He'll see to that. A burning sensation, but so brief.
Think of it as lightning, illuminating your soul. A starburst followed by quiet.
I felt tears well. I bet you introduced him to Terence Dace when he was admitted to the CCU.
He was very sick. He was doomed. I offered him a better death.
The aide came in, so I said good night. I said we'd come back for him. He lashed out at me so abruptly I could feel the blade displace the air as it whipped across my face. I jerked back. I put my hand behind me, grabbing the arm of the aluminum lawn chair to keep from stumbling. I glanced down and then swung the chair in a hard arc. I caught Linton by surprise, though he managed to get his arm up to soften the impact. He focused on me with curiosity, perhaps with a touch of respect. I wondered if he thought I'd go down without a fight. I held the chair in front of me, the four legs keeping him at bay. He paused to consider his options, and then lashed out again. He was quick in the way a striking snake is quick, out and back, hoping to bury his blade in me. I struck him with the chair, driving at him with all four legs, a hard bang as the two front legs jabbed his chest. I backed up and to my left, forcing him to shift right to keep me in range. From the corner of my eye, I saw a touch of white. The cat was out. Linton saw him at the same time I did, and I watched his eyes flicker toward Ed. I struck again to distract him. Ed paid no attention to either one of us. He sat down and licked his paw, grooming his face with a curling gesture that broke my heart. Now it was Linton who moved. I knew what he was up to. A demonstration. The Biter cutting to the bone. The simplicity of math. If not me, the cat. My only advantage was that I could devote both hands to the chair I held while his left hand was occupied. A lefty. I'd forgotten. He had his little friend to protect. I lunged, snapping the chair in front of me like a lion tamer. It was too light to do him any harm, but it created a buffer zone between us. He snatched at the chair, and I pushed abruptly, causing him to stumble backward by one step. I leaned left and grabbed a clay pot of marigolds by the rim. I threw it hard, directly at his face. A gash opened up on his forehead. Scalp wounds really are the most dramatic. No reaction from him. He probably didn't feel a thing. The biter flew again, and I didn't draw back in time. The blade nicked me on the cheek. Linton liked that, drawing blood for blood. I abandoned the chair. I grabbed the big plastic bag of sphagnum moss and held it in front of me like a chest protector. Linton struck, and the blade opened up a long slit. Moss bulged through the cut like internal organs being liberated. I stooped to the mound of lawn mulch and swept upward, an armload of fine dirt flying at his face. He inhaled silt and coughed. He backed up, his body racked as his lungs fought off the insult. The dirt had stuck to his sweaty skin, a minstrel in blackface. I grabbed a second clay pot and threw it. He deflected it with his arm. Striking him in the head was my only hope. His heavy coat offered him padding. I was in jeans, shirt, and running shoes, my movements unhampered where he had the bulk of his coat to contend with. The only sounds we made were the grunts of two tennis players putting everything we had into each shot. My body heat had jumped from chill to flame in the space of those few minutes. He was sweating. The biter must have been slippery in his fingers, but his grip was sure. I saw his eyes flicker again. I'd lost track of the cat, whereas Linton had not. Ed had retreated into the shrubs where he watched us warily. He crouched much closer to Linton than to me. I'd give up before I'd let Linton hurt the cat. My chest was on fire. My heart banged in my ears. I wanted to say, don't! I wanted to protest. Linton plunged into the bush and grabbed the cat. This was a mistake. Ed twisted and spat, hissing as he ripped into Linton with his claws. Linton struggled to secure his hold, but Ed propelled himself out of Linton's hands like a whirling dervish. Linton made a sound, and the cat was off like a shot. He put a hand to his cheek and then checked his fingertips. He was bleeding. I could see the angry red welt where Ed had made his mark with his rear claws. I needed a shield, something between me and the blade. The aluminum lawn chair had folded in on itself to form a flat metal plank. We grabbed for it at the same time, both of us now holding on with two hands. The biter remained in Linton's grip, but he couldn't maneuver the blade while clinging to the chair. He released his hold, allowing me full possession for all the good it would do. The chair was crudely constructed, not meant to endure much in the way of punishment. It was already growing heavy. My arms burned from the weight. Linton wanted full access. No impediments, just me and the small, deadly rapier no bigger than his index finger. I heaved the chair at him, but I was too tired to do so with any force. He backed up a step and the chair dropped with scarcely a sound. He lashed, and as I jumped, I banged into the potting bench. I snatched the pruning shears from the spot where they were affixed to the garage wall. The second set was bigger, but I had to work with what was closest to hand. I opened the blades and chopped at him. The sound was good, so I chopped at him again. I swung the shears as though at batting practice. Linton's face was red and his breathing was hoarse. The sound of childhood asthma. I pictured him chubby, a white, fleshy boy, a sissy on the playground. I could have beaten him in second grade, but girls didn't do those things back then. I held the pruning shears low, giving my arms a rest. He struck. I jumped back, angling the shears in front of me. I whacked his left hand full force, hoping his fingers would loosen. He backed up a pace, pausing to catch his breath. In his hand,
The biter had the look of a claw. This was the difference between us. He was nuts. I was mad. His thinking was disorganized, while I wasn't thinking at all. I went after him. My only hope was to wear him down. He was heavier than I by a good 70 pounds. I was light on my feet. I was speedier. I would never give up. I would fight to the death if that's what it took. He had his hands on his knees. He panted. I moved toward him, pulling the shears back like a baseball bat. I knew the risk. Linton might not be as tired as he looked. I might not be as strong. I drove at him, aiming for his head. His hand came up to protect his face. I struck the biter on follow-through and watched the scalpel fly off into the dark. When I looked down, Linton was on his back. His coat was caught under him, leaving his belly exposed. I lifted the shears above my head like a sword. Someone said, "Kinsey, it's okay. You don't have to do that." Cheney stood in the drive. He hadn't even drawn his gun. He knew I could do it, but trusted that I would not. Anna, white-faced and mute, stood behind him. Epilogue. The district attorney filed first-degree murder charges against Dr. Linton Reed in the shooting death of Pete Walensky. Involuntary manslaughter charges were also brought against Reed for the deaths of R. Terence Dace, Charles Farmer, and Sebastian Glenn, whose participation in the Glucotase scandal resulted in misdiagnosis and medical mismanagement. The DA theorized that once the first victim died, Reed's continuation of the suspect drug regimen amounted to criminal negligence. Dr. Linton Reed, through his attorney, declined all requests to be interviewed by the police. He took a leave of absence from the university, where his research was suspended. His wife's family is sufficiently wealthy to underwrite his legal expenses, but after an initial outpouring of protests as to his innocence, his wife has begun to disassociate herself from this once well-regarded young researcher whose star fell so swiftly to earth. "Better to be married to a bum than a criminal," says she. Eventually, a deal was reached between the DA and Reed's attorney for a plea to voluntary manslaughter with a gun use for 21 years in prison. Part of the plea deal was dismissal of the involuntary manslaughter charges in the deaths of the three homeless men, because all three suffered from multiple debilitating diseases that, individually or together, could have proved fatal. Analysis confirmed Dace's claim that the medication he was taking was indeed Glucotase, which was probably responsible for his failing health and eventual death, as well as that of Charles Farmer and Sebastian Glenn. Nonetheless, the DA's deal with Dr. Reed was supported by Dace's three children, who announced at the same time that they'd reached an out-of-court settlement with Reed, the university, and Paxton Pfeiffer, the pharmaceutical company that had supported his research. Each of the Dace children received $150,000 in compensation for their pain and suffering. Dace's will went unchallenged, in part because the legal costs would have been prohibitive, but more importantly, because it would have been inconsistent to claim in a civil suit that their father was of sound mind and body and a victim of premature death at the hands of Reed, thereby justifying a monetary award, and at the same time assert he was so debilitated as a result of drink that he could not competently decide as to the disposition of his assets. You may wonder, as who has not, what I did with the $500,000 that fell into my lap. After less than 1 minute of consideration, this is the plan I came up with. I made a generous donation to Harbor House, and then I put the rest in my retirement account. Do I feel at all apologetic about my good fortune?
Of course not. Are you nuts? But these are procedural odds and ends. Some of them, months in the making. Dry matters when laid up against the lives of Terence Dace and Felix Bider. I paid to have their remains cremated with the intention of scattering their ashes at some future date. According to the municipal codes governing this matter, I learned that it is illegal to scatter ashes at a public golf course, a public beach, or a public park. Though it was not specifically spelled out, I was certain that flinging them off a freeway overpass would be frowned upon as well. So I set that decision aside temporarily. I put William in charge of the memorial service, which was held on the grassy area at the beach where the homeless congregate most days when the weather's good. There was no sign of Ethan, but Anna was in attendance, as were Ellen and her young family, who'd driven down from Bakersfield. The children had never seen the ocean, and they ran barefoot and shrieking to the water's edge under Hank's watchful eye. William was amused by their enthusiasm, smiling to himself as they danced in the surf. Henry had adapted and copied portions of Dace's botanical folios to create a program commemorating the farewell. Pearl and Dandy were there, along with their new friend, Plato the Preacher Man. Ken and Belva and the other volunteers from Harbor House made an appearance, along with assorted staff members. There was no drinking, of course, and I'm happy to report Pearl only excused herself once for a quick smoke behind a tree. The day was sunny, the temperature in the mid-60s. William wore his best three-piece suit, as was fitting for the occasion. His white hair was riffled by the breeze coming off the ocean, and his voice, powdery with age, rang clearly in the open air, in consequence, he later pointed out, of his early mastery of elocution. William selected and arranged for the music, saying no send-off would be complete without hymns. He'd hired a solo trumpeter, on my dime, of course, who opened the service by playing Amazing Grace. Strangers passing along the beach path recognized the solemnity of the gathering and paused, looking on respectfully. Cyclists, walkers, joggers, and mothers pushing strollers lingered at the periphery until the crowd numbered close to 60 by my count. When the trumpeter finished, William welcomed everyone and thanked them for coming. He recited the Lord's Prayer, and those who knew it chimed in. He read the 23rd Psalm. There was no proselytizing, and none of the formalities rested too heavily on the Christian side of the equation. As he said, his purpose was not to convert, but to express the optimism of faith in all its forms. He and Henry then joined in a duet, singing an a cappella rendition of the spiritual Going Home. Their two strong tenor voices blended in a harmony that was both simple and sublime. I'd never heard Henry sing, and certainly not in concert with his brother. Thereafter, William invited remembrances from those who'd been acquainted with Terence and Felix. Ellen couldn't bring herself to speak, too shy in a public setting and far too upset to talk about her father. Anna talked about his love of nature, and then Dandy and Pearl both told stories about the two. Their recollections were varied and amusing, with more laughter generated than you'd expect. Or maybe the laughter was exactly appropriate. I've never attended a funeral yet where those present were not bound by both tears and mirth. It was William who captured the sentiment. William's eulogy was brief. We are here this afternoon to mourn the passing of two good friends, Terence Dace and Felix Bider. They were homeless. Their ways were not those we most desire for ourselves, but that didn't make them wrong. We seemed determined to save the homeless, to fix them, to change them into something other than what they are. We want them to be like us, but they are not. The homeless do not want our pity, nor do they deserve our scorn.
Our judgments about them, for good or for ill, negate their right to live as they please. Both the urge to rescue and the need to condemn fail to take into account the concept of their personal liberty, which they may exercise as they see fit, as long as their actions fall within the law. The homeless are not lesser mortals. For Terence and Felix, their battles were within, and their victories hard won. I think of these two men as soldiers of the poor, part of an army of the disaffiliated. The homeless have established a nation within a nation. But we are not at war. Why should we not coexist in peace when we may be in greater need of salvation than they? This is what the homeless long for. Respect, freedom from hunger, shelter from the elements, safety, the companionship of the like-minded. They want to live without fear. They want to enjoy the probity of the open air without the risk of bodily harm. They want to be warm. They want the comfort of a clean bed when they are ill, relief from pain, a hand offered in friendship, ordinary conversation, simple needs. Why are their choices so hard for us to accept? What you see before you is their home. This is their dwelling place. This grass, this sunlight, these palms, this mighty ocean, the moon, the stars, the clouds overhead, though they sometimes harbor rain. Under this canopy they have staked out a life for themselves. For Terence and for Felix, this is also the wide bridge over which they passed from life into death. Their graves will be unmarked, but that does not mean they are forgotten. The earth remembers them, even as it gathers them tenderly into its embrace. The sky still claims them, and we who honor them will hold them dear from this day forward. In closing, the trumpeter sounded taps. When the service ended, people hugged and shook hands and wiped their eyes and blew their noses, connected for that small window in time. The camaraderie might never rise to the fore again, but I believe it was heartfelt and genuine while it lasted. As for the matter of the ashes, William and Henry and I considered scattering them along the beach, thus committing an act of civil disobedience. But in the end, Henry came up with a better idea. We took the ashes home with us, and in a private ceremony of our own, we folded them into the rich earth in Henry's flower beds, where they'll nourish the roses when spring comes again. Respectfully submitted, Kinsey Milhone. This is Judy Kay. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of W is for Wasted by Sue Grafton. This program was directed by Scott Cresswell, executive producer Orly Moskowitz. Text copyright 2013 by Sue Grafton, production copyright 2013 Random House LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.